This meeting is being recorded.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Ah, hello, Kevin Hutchcroft, HHS, and I don't know, I can't tell from my telephone who is here. Mr. Chair, Derek, will you please go next?
Sure. I just introduced myself.
Okay.
I'll throw it to Richard.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Kevin. Hey, everyone. Richard Sullivan, council member. Melina?
Everyone, Melina Clark, council staff. And Kira.
Hi, everyone. Kira, council staff. And David.
Jordan, council staff. Lee?
I already did it. It's
Yes, that's everyone. So we'll be looking at the agenda for today. I thanks for sending out the draft agenda, the update. Is there anything that folks feel they would like to add on the agenda item?
Can everyone see this okay?
Yes, this doesn't look like the updated one that I have.
Oh.
The only difference is the we were going to talk about the return to person as well, but we don't have quorum.
Okay.
So I don't know if we can vote on that item.
Okay.
So should we take that item off for the time being?
So I would say that you can have a conversation about it and then put forward a recommendation that can go to steering, and we can just report what the folks in this room felt about returning to in-person meetings. And it functionally, it doesn't really matter if it was a vote or not, because steering and the co-chairs are going to be sort of weighing everybody's thoughts anyways. And there was that poll that went out, so.
Right. And I think actually this is much more reflective of this group, whether or not this group would be returning to in person.
I think it is this group, but also the
greater group.
It all also goes into the larger conversation of where we are given the sort of exposure from last week.
Okay, right. All right, yeah, we can definitely have a discussion about it if folks would like that, and we can forward it unvoted upon to steering. Would everybody be okay with that? I really can't. Okay. I'm going to put that as a hint. So let's look at last month's agenda minutes. Are there any additions or subtractions that people would like to make to the minutes from last month? Okay, so hearing nothing, I'll take that as assent and approval of last month's minutes. Thank you. Are there any announcements? All right. There's no public here for public comments. So let's move on to the next item. I have just received the HCAP report. Steve, it is not here. I don't know if it's worth looking at the reports. Do we generally look at the reports without Stephen?
I feel like when Stephen does the HCAP report, he usually, because like I have the report here and it's like 8 pages long, and I feel like he will usually
right.
Summarize or highlight a few particular cases. which I wouldn't be able to do. So I could scroll through it if you all want, but it might be easier to like read it on your own. I don't know what people think.
Generally, we just sort of scroll through share screen the new cases, which is usually only about a page or two.
Okay.
If we wanted to quickly review those, see if there was anything that we wanted to discuss, you guys all have access to it, so then you can also just read it on your own time and send any questions to Stephen via email, and maybe that will be that. Oftentimes when he's not available, we just double up the following month. So this is an unusual situation where he was kind of unavailable at the last moment.
Very well. That actually might be a choice thing to do. We all have a copy of it. With folks here's assent, let's read it on our own. And if we have any immediate questions, just the email Stephen, and we'll double up next month. If he has some items that he needs to highlight from us, or if folks are bringing him questions, he can address them then. Thanks, Melinda. Thanks, Dave. We are at the needs assessments color targets. I'll let you take it away, Melinda.
Okay, thanks, Derek. So like Dave said, we don't actually have a ton to report on. We're in the stages of putting together the surveys and doing outreach to folks. But we are really excited to be working with you, Derek, to do the long-term survivors COLA later this month. So I'm really glad we have that on the schedule and coming up soon. And I'm kind of blanking on like what else to update the group on. I don't know if Dave or Kira, if you have anything.
Yeah, more, less updated, more sort of questions on both the COLA and the needs assessment recently. So during quarantine, we've sort of been trying to examine our methodology to figure out what is more effective than what we've been doing. We're clearly having an ebb and flow of sort of flirting with in-person interventions and then back to remote and then back again. So sort of modality and methodology stuff is sort of at the forefront of my mind recently around how to approach this. And so I will start with at steering last month, when we discussed the long-term survivor COLA, there was some conversation around what long-term survivor meant functionally, definitely as a definition. And I think some people, I've heard some very specific definitions and others, we have actually done this population sort of previously, or at least things very much adjacent to it. And an interesting idea came up from Bill Bloom, I believe, sort of voiced this, was that if we are approaching long-term survivorhood as a self-identify situation, people can perceive it differently. And how you might perceive it among for yourself or among peers might not be the same. And what Bill was sort of expressing was that there is a distinct difference between those people who were sort of pre-treatments and post-treatments, or pre very effective treatments and post, you know, ART.
Post-part.
Exactly. And how, and Richard was part of this conversation as well. So I don't know if he has any thoughts on this. He actually expressed sort of how he sort of felt about himself at the time which I thought was interesting. I thought it was an interesting way to approach this. And I was wondering if we felt like that would be, because I know we hear, you know, we hear famously hear from some of our members of the public who have come, who feel like we have left them behind, the specifically those people who were in that, you know, pre-art phase of HIV epidemic, who, you know, who had take umbrage with the idea that that AIDS is no longer even a diagnosis, and that people who the epidemic has been around long enough that there are people who could be considered long-term survivors who have only been positive in a world in which there were highly effective treatments. And so might that be part of the conversation, or should we focus on that? Because it feels like, given that we've done this topic or topics adjacent to this pretty regularly, it might be a thing thematically worth exploring. Although sort of, I wouldn't want to be, you know, exclude people who maybe don't fall into that category, but just having, focusing the conversation around that. I see Lee has his hand up.
Thank you. I say whatever we need to do to make it more inclusive, let's do it. I don't have a problem with semantics or adding categories that include people. We want to get as many people in the mix as possible.
Certainly, and that's always our goal. I think that for me, it's more about framing the conversation itself, because we can just do it very straightforward, sort of, you all identify as, any person who takes part in this identifies as a long-term survivor, regardless of where they fall into those, either of those two camps, as previously discussed. And just go through our sort of standard, like, let's talk about your quality of life. Let's talk about your engagement in services. Let's talk about sort of all of those pieces and tracking down to sort of more specifics. But I'm not sure that gives us anything we haven't seen, because let's be honest, this is a population that gets a lot of eyeballs on it, and quite a bit of focus. And this seemed like a novel way to approach the conversation. And I was wondering if people had specific thoughts about maybe how to frame that or how to shape that, or other pieces adjacent to that that might be helpful in sort of getting some information that is truly useful to us, novel information that's useful to us. Richard?
Yeah, Dave, would it be too much trouble, too much work to have two sets of questions? Like when you sit down with someone, do you ask like upfront, how long have you lived with the virus?
It's in the survey. So,
huh?
It's in the survey.
Yeah, so people that identify, maybe, I don't know, whatever number you want to use, people that identify living with the virus for 20 plus years, and then a set of questions for those who identify as being 20 under years out of the 41 year epidemic. You know, two separate questions, and then you can fill, I'm that would be up to you, but you might get distinctly different answers. Long people 20 plus in the teeth of the epidemic, losing people, that nature. Then people like me, I've lived well with HIV for 17 years because I came in after ARTS. You know, so there would be different stories maybe if you could have, what, long story short, are two separate forms of questions and you decide where the cutoff would be.
I think that presumes that we would be doing these as individual surveys. I think with this COLA, the hope is that we would be dovetailing it with Derek's long-term survivor group that is meeting in person, correct? Or are you back to? Yes, so this would be a facilitated conversation. Derek, I mean, I've done this with your group actually not that long ago, maybe 3 years ago. Presumably it's largely the same folks.
No.
Okay.
No.
So, given that, do you feel as though most of those folks fall into that post-art or pre-art category?
Majority of these guys A majority of them fit pre. There are some that fit post. I have yet to have someone born HIV positive in the group. So, but I have had at least one person who comes pretty close to that. He was someone who became HIV positive as a sex worker at the age of 14. But outside of that, like no one born HIV positive.
Okay, so I guess my thought is does this feel like an interesting and maybe fruitful way to frame a conversation that could end up that without some sort of additional framing or a different sort of perspective on it could end up feeling a little bit rote, because we're always looking for ways to make this not sort of duplicative of things that other people are doing or things that we've done in the past. Or do you feel like this would be, I mean, I think that we can be pretty careful to not make people feel excluded and or tokenized or sort of put on the spot for their sort of, you know, stance, for their sort of place in the history of the epidemic. Does this feel like an approach that we want to follow up with?
I will say this, like there's I keep on thinking that there's much more of a process behind the scenes with this. So the discussion could be the same, but the information that you gather about each person and then process that data could be more revealing without necessarily beating people's conversations. So for instance, we could have the same conversation and the demographic information that you gather about the person can allow for interpretation, unbiased interpretation about, you know, these number of people are pre-heart and these are much more of their concerns from pre-heart people or folks that are post-heart or just individuals that are older with HIV, but were, you know, only been positive for the last, you know, 10 years, as opposed to folks that were positive in 20 plus years. Do you get what I'm saying?
I do get that. I do feel like because
but it's still having the same conversation.
Because our survey basically generally captures all of that information as is, we can choose to sort of put more focus on it. It does, one challenge is that generally the surveys are anonymous, even in a group facilitation focus group sort of situation. And so sort of combining what people have said and what they put in their survey is challenging and can be problematic. So we're generally doing like only the demographics in aggregate. We can add some more specific questions around treatment and sort of where a person fits into sort of historically in the treatment sort of spectrum or, the historical line of different treatments available and or not. I guess also, but part of the conversation that I think we found so interesting because we had a room in steering where we had a number of people, or at least, you know, two people who were both self-identified long-term survivors who had been pre-heart, lived pre-heart and experienced the sort of that, the real dark days of the epidemic as we think of them. And then we had at least one person who hadn't, but also could be considered a long-term survivor. Or maybe two people who hadn't, who could be considered long-term survivors as well, just based on timeline or just time. And I think that the interesting part of this question, because I think that without naming names, some of you may remember a specific member of public who had used to come to meetings quite often with complaints that were sort of adjacent to this idea that generation of long-term survivor was being disregarded. And I think it is also has sort of carries into some of the things that we heard from the two gentlemen that were here 2 months ago and some of their concerns about what that generation of long-term survivors experienced and how we may or have sort of disregarded their specific challenges and needs. And I think that if carefully facilitated, this could be a really interesting, fruitful conversation to have with a group of people in an intentional way, as opposed to doing an anonymous survey where people aren't interacting with each other's ideas. I think that's where the sort of the meat really lays with this, the what we get out of this that is interesting and novel and potentially useful in informing how we think about this population.
So literally having a group dialogue, not necessarily with the group and staff, but the group with itself in terms of this set of folks are pre-heart, these are the post-heart folks. Let's talk about that sort of experience and how that experience shape your thought and experience.
That's not what I was suggesting. No, what I was suggesting is that we have a focus group, a facilitated conversation with staff in which we sort of guide them through that conversation as a group, sort of with some intentional preloaded questions around that. So starting with the sort of our real kind of generalized base questions around service utilization, quality of life, but then sort of branching, because generally how this works is we sort of ask those questions, people start sharing their specific challenges, and oftentimes those specific challenges really do have everything to do with where they fit on that spectrum in some ways, or what their history is. Regardless of whether long-term survivors or not, it is often about their personal history and with the system of care, with their own personal health, with the sort of global nature of their lives. And so I guess that I would like to have that conversation with that group while being able to sort of frame it in like terms of as discussed, if the idea that you're gathered here is long-term survivors and some have experienced a different type of survival than others, and what does that mean for you as a group? What does it mean for you as individuals? What does it mean? How do people feel about that idea? How does it affect your sort of willingness to engage in the system of care? What services do you engage with? How do you perceive? I've worked with like youth and the way they perceive the system of care and HIV in general is wildly different. And I think that I would like to hear what that looks like from the perspective of the folks that you're working with. Or we could just do what we usually do, or we can come up with some other way to frame it that is interesting and helpful. This was just, this did not come from me necessarily. This came from a group conversation among long-term survivors, which is why I felt like it was potentially very fruitful, because just what I heard in that space, in the brief conversation that we had that was probably no more than 10 minutes, felt like it was leading towards something, something, you know, useful. I'm not going to presume because I'm not one of them, you know?
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. I mean, I'm not one of them either. I think I just generally, so I'm struggling with how to offer some, you know, concrete advice in terms of how to frame this discussion with them. I think you're doing a good job of it already, given that you've had contact with these people and have heard from them directly. So it's a little hard for me just to provide anything additional in from what you're already offering. And I would trust you with this regardless.
I appreciate the vote of confidence. I guess my thought is, I feel like we need to start innovating the ways in which we approach these outreach efforts and needs assessments, COLAs and so forth, and figure out a way to, because, you know, what we do here is not, it's not about the numbers or the demographics, because we are not looking at sample sizes that are useful enough in size that really speak to that very much. Our demographic information has always only been as context for the qualitative information we get. And so to that end, I'm always looking for ways to get the best version of qualitative information we can access. Sometimes that is through individual depth. Sometimes that is through, you know, casting a wider net and hearing a broad spectrum of opinions. And sometimes it is through really framing the questions we're asking to get at a certain idea. And we've done this in the past in different respects, where we're working with different populations that are set part of the same, so different subpopulations that are part of the same larger population, but have distinct differences because of race, gender, age, socioeconomic, whatever. And we are asking slightly different things of them. We're asking to get a sense of how their needs are distinct across those differences, or the same potentially. But so I think it is, we've done some of this sort of like specific framing before. I guess I just wanted to get an idea of like, is this a thing we feel like we should pursue? And Derek, I guess most specifically, is this the thing that you feel like your guys are going to be receptive to, if handled sort of compassionately?
I think it's worth giving it a try and see what you discover from them.
Okay, so we can move forward with that. If anyone has any specific thoughts around framing devices or anything like that, Derek, if you have any interest in sort of helping with what would be very helpful in this conversation, is maybe something akin to a brief timeline history that could sort of help sort of set up this is how we got where we are. I mean, most of these guys are probably going to be aware of that because they lived it, but it doesn't hurt to sort of, I mean, I can do that also. I am aware enough of the history largely without having a personal experience that I can provide some waypoints that are important. But you know, if you were interested in doing that as part of the setup for this conversation, that might be helpful. And if you have any sort of thoughts upon reflection about how we might approach this, that would also be helpful. And that goes to all of you.
Sure. I know that Greg had done something very similar a handful of years ago, and I'll see what chart that he might still have floating around. It might be nice to develop that.
Okay, cool. Thank you. And this is a more generalized thing, is you know, we're moving forward with the trans focused needs assessments. And again, trans the trans population, the HIV positive trans population in San Francisco is has some very distinct subgroups. And we are going to be approaching a variety of different service providers, many of them who provide service to only one of those subgroups, be they sort of primarily African-American, primarily Spanish-speaking, primarily Filipino. Those are all populations that we see a lot of, you know, people, you know, trans populations who are sex workers or have been sex workers. I'd like to put a thought in your heads around helping us think about framing and how we go about getting the best version of that information. To sort of apply the differences and similarities between those subgroups. And some of that might be, as I said, not just about framing, but it might be like a actual sort of functional modality difference. Maybe just a facilitated conversation is not the way to go about it. Maybe not surveys, maybe not, you know, maybe something more experiential. I don't know. I'm trying to think of ways to make this information engaging to the larger group in a way that you know, people feel like maybe it isn't all the time. Because if we ask the same questions, we're going to get the same answers.
Yeah, it might be worthwhile finding one or two people that you think might be worth kind of bringing this to them for, and seeing what kind of response you get. And I agree, the best way, I mean, if you can engage them in a way that engages them and gets the information that we need, you know, yes, let's definitely do it. I'm just wondering if finding one or two people with Derek and or Greg might be worthwhile to just, you know, talking to initially.
Maybe it might be worth having a conversation, a pre-conversation ahead of the focus group.
Yeah, I mean, and then you can incorporate that into all of your questions in the future, like how can we make, just generally, how can we make this more engaging for you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and this is also, how do I make it more engaging for the council, who is the final target of this information? Because I'll be honest, a lot of times council members, when getting these presentations, what they want are graphs and charts and pictures and things that are visually stimulating. But what we do is qualitative information gathering, and that often doesn't come in the form of charts and graphs and pictures. That's people's voices. That's people's, you know, history. How do we make that a thing that catches people's attention and makes them sort of feel like this is worth listening to? Because I'll be honest with you guys, there have been times, especially most recently, that and maybe post-merge more distinctly, that I've worked very hard to come up with some ideas, next steps and recommendations, and people fucking don't pay attention to them because they've checked out, because they feel like they're hearing the same stories that they hear all the time. And if we're going to make this worthwhile, and if I'm truly going to represent communities' voices, because I talk to these people individually and I care about their quality of life, and sometimes the things I hear are heartbreaking and I want to make a positive change, otherwise I would not be doing this job, right? And if I make the presentation and the council at large kind of was like, okay, cool, thank you very much for your efforts, and let's move on to the next thing, then I failed those community members who took the time to talk to me.
Well, so let me just say, I totally get what you're saying, and I'm hearing a little bit of frustration and a desire to figure out how you can improve all of this. And I don't think that the reaction that you get is wholly the way the information is being presented. I think it has a lot to do with how council business is conducted, the limited amount of impact that we can have in many ways, especially for those communities in need. I mean, housing is always one of the biggest concerns, and that we can't do anything about it, right? So, I mean, I think there's so many factors that go into a council member and or the effectiveness that we can have on people's direct lives, right? I think that's part of the structural challenge that we face every year. And I think that every council faces across the country. So I don't think that's new. What I've been thinking about for the last few years is, how do we really make our funding categories more effective that will really make a difference to the client populations most at need? I think that kind of reform, or at least that kind of inquiry, is worth looking at eventually. Because right now, it's true, we aren't, it doesn't really meet the needs.
It doesn't meet the needs for those most vulnerable. But also the system is not designed for those folks. And I will say that generally, I know where our mad money lives. I mean, we all know that if we want to pilot a thing, if we want to make a thing happen quickly, it comes from carry forward. And when I make recommendations, largely I'm targeting them at carry forward fund. I'm like, what can I do with less than $10,000 that has a direct impact concretely on the people who I spoke to in the last 3 months?
Well, I would say do that. Like, we could talk about that here and then just gain a support for it and bring it forward as a vote.
And so, for instance, in the most recent needs assessment, when we did the community forum at the meeting, there were recommendations attached to that that could have been potentially accomplished with carry forward funding. And in past years, I feel like council members would have said, come up with a motion to sort of, you know, say like, let's explore this idea at least, or let's move forward with this idea. And we've done things like, you know, the lockers a few years ago, like training for front desk staff, that kind of stuff. We've had motions that utilize carry forward funding that came out of needs assessments, and I feel like we've lost that somewhere. And maybe what we need to do is start that forward motion here and have a motion come out of this body before it goes to full council. Maybe that's the way to do it. Clearly, that is a better idea than just expecting people to hear ideas cold and pick them up as their own cause right away. But anyways, so this is not just me bitching at you guys. I'm really trying to sort of proactively examine our process and fine tune and improve, or just reinvent create something new out of whole cloth if necessary.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Dave. Like, I know, like, part of what I was hearing also was also this idea of, you know, what are some new tricks, as it were, like creating a game book that you can refer to and be able to try out different techniques and different ways of not just approaching the community members at different, you know, different types of community members, but also what you were just saying, like, so how do I present this in a way that stimulates? But I absolutely like what Lee was saying, like, you know, if that's who you're aiming at, it's the carry forward dollars, like, make it plain. You know, I have much more of the sense that and I hope you guys get this, like, the work that you're doing is informing council and has developed programs. I think what you guys were saying, like, they're such limited spaces that we can move into to actually make this sort of substantial changes that we would wish to have for our community. And maybe that, you know what, I keep on thinking, even right now, I think there's the folks from the Harvey Milk group that is, their HIV caucus is over at City Hall right now, ready to talk to the supervisors about some funding cuts. Maybe as council members, how we promote or are involved in that level of advocacy work in terms of the stuff that we do and in terms of wanting to make changes and how we approach our work, maybe that's part of what we should be looking at. But I realize that that's not necessarily on this level. It's going to be at a federal level or the state level. And that, I think that's a bit, I think that's going to need to come from our own self-motivation as members to get more involved in that sort of work and activity. It's been quite a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes. And I think that we always have to remind ourselves of, or at least you guys as council members and me as council staff, have to be, you know, cognizant of the sort of line between sort of advocacy versus sort of legislative, lobbying, which is a big no-no.
Right.
And I mean, to your original point or to your earlier point, I think that there was a point where I do feel like every year we brought this a presentation to you guys, you know, and especially in combined with EPI or ARES or both. And we're able to sort of feel like, okay, we're fitting into the puzzle. We are all working towards a common goal. We've identified specific needs and we've identified specific ways to address some of those needs within the sort of funding available to us, meaning generally carry forward. Because I know that the larger sort of, Ryan White Part A funding is, it's spoken for. We're not changing that. Maybe we can sort of find a way to fit into some of those things occasionally, but I feel like that is really tapered off in recent years. And mostly what we hear is, it's repetitive. It's, you know, not dynamic enough. I mean, I don't know if you guys want like sparklers and fireworks, you know, sort of a can-can line of, you know, dancing boys, but boys and girls maybe. And boys and girls and non-binary dancing people.
I think context is important here. This has become very routine, and that's because a lot of this stems from the huge funding cut that Part A received, right, a number of years ago, over a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a real desire to standardize it and make it routine so there wasn't that kind of upset and dealing with scarce resources, right? We've never had, thanks to the Board of Supervisors, we have additional resources that the federal government doesn't provide. That's not true across the country, but we're still dealing with not enough funds for a population whose needs are continuing to be more complex. So, I mean, I think context is important in here. And I understand that sentiment that it's a little too routine, but I think the reason for that is important to know. And, you know, what do we want to do about it, right? We can start having that conversation if we want. And part of what I'm talking about is are the funds that we routinely allocate year after year really going to the is it the best use of our resources given the pandemic as it exists today?
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you guys for, you know, joining me in, on this journey. I think that's all I have, but I appreciate it if people just sort of had this in the back of their minds and be thinking about this. And maybe as we come towards the end of the needs assessment cycle this year, we can be thinking about the flip, the far side of this. So as opposed to sort of methodology in data acquisition, we're thinking about methodology and modalities and presentation. And hopefully we can come up with something that is more engaging and galvanizing for the rest of the council as a group.
I think we can definitely have that conversation. It may be something that will take more than, you know, I mean, I think we need to be, it needs to be an open-ended discussion and maybe eventually have a timeline, but I don't know if that's going to happen for this, you know, this year, right? Mm.
Thank you so much, everyone. We are at 7 o'clock and
4 o'clock.
Oh, I'm sorry. 4 o'clock. I'm obviously in a different place.
By the way, Kevin, it's so nice to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lee. By the way, I'm all for the dancing boys. Just wanted to get that on the record for sure.
Thank you. So the next agenda item actually is in-person meeting. Just a quick discussion about that. And shall we start with ourselves? I think one board is whether we would like to continue as a virtual group or should we go back to in-person, which I would think would be at 25 NS.
So I'd like to keep it virtual. It really works with my schedule. We also received that email from Mark saying that at our first in-person council meeting, we had, 3 positive cases come forward. You know, my concern is that if we start doing in-person, it's going to be really challenging for people that may be concerned about that. And we get people who won't show up.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, so sort of for the sake of honesty, I will say that I was one of the people who ended up getting sick, getting COVID a few days after that meeting, a couple days. That was probably my only real likelihood of exposure, you know, two in-person meetings back and I got COVID after 2 years of being safe. Now, I could have gotten on the train on the way there. What didn't necessarily have to be the meeting itself. But I do think that in coming out of this, having had it, I probably am safer than most from getting COVID again. So that is a thing. But that said, I feel like if there are enough people who feel uncomfortable with the idea of moving forward, I don't even know that this should be a vote. I think that it should be a matter of sort of moral obligation for those of us who, you know, for those people who are pro going back or on the fence, to be really considerate of those folks who do not feel comfortable or feel unsafe. Because in a lot of other respects, we would completely halt any behavior that made people feel unsafe, regardless of how small that population was.
Richard?
Yeah, so what Dave just said, I'm all on board with. If people, I'll go with that. And for this meeting right here, what we're talking about, I'd prefer that we stay virtual. This seems to work. It's a small group. I don't want to have to see people traveling around and getting out of their houses and doing things. I mean, I put in my word for the full council meeting. I didn't say this lightly either, but I said, yeah, I'd like that to stay in person. But I also, if the majority don't want that, I'm not going to buck that at all. I understand. And I would go with people's concerns. But I don't say that lightly because I was one of the people that got the call the next day. I sat next to someone. I didn't know why they were calling me. Hey, how you doing? And at the end of the phone call, it dawned on me, oh, my. So I waited the appropriate amount of time, tested, and came back negative. But it definitely, you know, I stay safe, and I have a compromised immune system, and I've never got COVID this whole 2.5 years. I lived in transitional housing and everything, but so I kind of had it in the mirror, but not. And when I got that call and had to start taking precautions and canceling appointments, it really, I didn't like it. You know, it's like, fuck, this thing is still here, man. I had to cancel a peer volunteer client with Shanti, obviously, baseball game, a bunch of other commitments. And that's minor, but it just let me know that this thing's around. And like I said, I'm like some others, I have a compromised immune system. I don't want to get sick. I don't want to challenge this, but so I'll go with the flow. But for the community engagement meeting, definitely virtual. And I'll go with the group on the in-person council.
Kevin, do you have any feedback?
I don't see enough of a advantage with deciding to go forward with in-person meetings versus the potential risk. So it's a risk analysis. And I wouldn't change the virtual meetings at this point.
Right. Since there's no vote to this, I think what Dave was saying earlier, this is information that we could move forward to steering and they'll be making decisions for the full group, and everyone has already taken the survey, or hopefully they've done the survey, and they'll be making their own decision. We'll be making decision. We can let them know what this group talked about in regards to in person for itself, and we'll be virtual at least for the next meeting, and hopefully there'll be enough folks here that we can continue that discussion have a vote when we have quorum. I have a feeling that it will be reflective of what we talked about here. And so thanks guys for talking about that. And I'm not gonna beat a dead horse. I kind of feel the same way as everyone here has expressed. I remain negative, and I'm hoping to remain negative for COVID. And so this also sort of works for me in my scheduling to be virtual. So what's helped me to be here today. I will say this, like I am open to being in person if there are other sort of structural changes in how we meet. And I don't know if we're in the place to do things like having people test before the meeting and reporting what that test says and that sort of thing. And you know, of course, there's the idea of like when and where to do those tests before coming to the meeting and the costs that are related to that.
To that end, we could, I mean, we, I'm sure we could find a place in the budget, council staff budget, to send out home tests to all council members to use before, say, full council meetings. It sounds like full council is going to be virtual this month, based on the poll, but I think it's still up for debate at the co-chairs meeting this upcoming. But that is a good idea. We should potentially, that's a thing that we can bring to steering. And so presumably Derek or Richard will be at steering. You can sort of relay what was discussed here. If not, I can relay it as well. So, but I think the idea of sort of providing home tests is worth doing, you know?
You know, part of my response to the survey, like I said, I go with the group, but me individually, I said, yeah, I'd like to see return in-person stay for full council. And part of that was wrong on my part. I got mad. I'm mad at COVID, you know what I mean? And when we went back in person and people saw each other and then this thing fucking popped up again, I was like, you know what? I wanted to stand up to it, but bullheadedness doesn't work with the virus. You know, I say that in all seriousness, but I hate it. So, you know, what do you keep raining on our parade for? I wanted to like stand up to it and stay in person, but that's really not winning the show, you know? So that's where I stand. Caution above all, like Dave and Kevin put so succinctly, I agree with those.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very well. Thanks guys for that discussion. We are at 409. Our next meeting is June 1st via Zoom, of course. I think we have the agenda items already prepared. I think we were also going to, are we going to add additional piece around in-person meeting for that next meeting?
I mean, we can leave that on the agenda as just sort of a standing item in case things evolve and change between then and now. I imagine there will be word coming from leadership, co-chairs and so forth about what our status is. So we maybe want to have an opportunity to discuss that. So we may as well leave that as a standing agenda item.
Sure. Does anyone have, because we do have a little bit of time here, I just wanted to ask really fast if anyone had anything else they wanted to comment on or talk about from our agenda items? Okay.
Derek, I will just really quickly, as a sort of process point here, you can sort of ask if people have additional things to add to the next agenda, but we can't actually use the time today to discuss anything that's not agenda.
Anything new, right. Thanks for that. We stand adjourned.
Cool. Thank you, Derek.
See you guys next month. Thank you.
Thanks, Derek. Bye, everyone.